Welcome to Conscious Curiosity SD, where successful San Diego leaders share their stories of leading beyond profit and are using the influence of business to positively change the companies and communities we all work and live in. I'm your host, Jeff Blanton from Jailbreak Leadership, a proven and powerful process for unlocking the full potential of the people and teams across your organization, giving you the competitive advantage in the marketplace. We want to thank our collaborative community of business organizations, the Better Business Bureau, Conscious Capitalism, Cause San Diego, and Be Local, who are all focused on impacting our community of San Diego through the work they do as business leaders. Welcome to the show. Have you ever met someone whose very presence softens the room, who brings peace just by being? And in the noisy, chaotic world, that kind of calm is rare. And yet, every time I'm with today's guest, I feel it. I feel it deeply. And I still marvel at how lucky I am to call him my friend. Azeem Kamisa, welcome to Conscious Curiosity SD.
Well, thank you, Jeff. And it's a pleasure to be with you. And well, you are a close friend and blessed to have you in my life.
Well, thank you. Azeem's life was forever altered when his son was tragically taken by an act of gang violence. Out of unimaginable pain, he chose a path few could, one of forgiveness, healing, and purpose. That choice has touched the lives of thousands across the globe. He has spoken to over 1,000 audiences, earned 80 awards, authored 5 books, and reached over 1 million people through his TED Talk. His voice is a beacon for ethical leadership, compassion, and the power of reconciliation across generations. Born in Kenya, educated in England, and fluent in 6 languages, Azeem is the CEO of Sovereign Capital Markets, an international investment banking firm, and serves as vice chair of the Institute of Noetic Sciences. But titles aside, the greatest wonder for me is, how does someone like this extraordinary person become my friend? We'll go call out for Jennifer Barnes, because we met at some party she was throwing, I don't know, 7 years ago or something like that.
That's true, yeah. It's good to see you again. And we see each other often.
So yes, weekly, almost.
Which is always a treat. Thank you.
So if you're willing, can you share the tragic moment that really kind of changed your whole projection in life?
Yeah, it was 30 years ago, although it's one of those events in your life that doesn't ever go away. You know, Tariq, my son, I have a daughter, but he was my only son, worked as a pizza delivery man while he was a student at SDSU. On weekends to, you know, make extra money for college. And he was lured to a bogus address in North Park. It was his turn. They gave the right address of the apartment building, but the wrong apartment number. So he knocked on many doors, found out nobody had ordered the pizza. So he came back to his car, put the pizzas in the trunk of his car, and he climbed into the driver's side seat. He was about to, you know, back his car from the driveway of the apartment building, was accosted by 4 young youth gang members. 3 of them were 14 years old, and the leader of the gang was an 18-year-old who gave an order to a 14-year-old, busting bones, a gang initiation. And he fired one round, which came through the driver's side window, entered my son's body on the left shoulder blade, actually traveled to the upper part of his chest, and it exited through his right armpit. But as the coroner explained to me afterwards, he said the bullet followed a perfect path. And I thought, a perfect path? I thought it was an interesting choice of words. But he was very quick to tell me, Mr. Kamisa, I'm not trying to be insensitive. We do not see a path like this very often. And what it means in my lingo is destroyed all the vital organs in your son's body. And Tariq died a couple of minutes later, drowning in his own blood over a lousy pizza at the age of 20. You know, the sudden senseless death of an innocent, unarmed human being, the overwhelming grief of a family never goes away. And 30 years later, it's never a day. I don't think about Tariq several times a day. You know, as you try to absorb this new hideous reality. And I went through all the emotions, Jeff, that you might expect a parent to go through. He was a good kid, brilliant writer, great photographer, kind, generous, good looking, had a nice girlfriend, joy to be around, great sense of humor. I wanted to be a journalist because, you know, he's inspired one day to work for National Geographic. So he was a big loss. And I remember one time, I really did not know how to go forward without him. I was, you know, I was suicidal at one point. I worked in international finance and did a lot of investment banking, and I was in Bulgaria and I had to go close a deal, you know, 3 weeks after he passed away. And they gave me all of these pills, you know, because I couldn't sleep, you know, at night. And I considered that maybe I should take them all, you know. Obviously, I didn't. And I think what saved me was my spiritual foundation. I started to meditate when I was 20. I lost him in my early 40s. I grew up in the Sufi faith. Sufis are the metaphysical interpretation of Islam. My mother was very spiritual. My dad was a businessman. So I grew up with equal emphasis on my spiritual life and my career. And thank God I did start to meditate at that early age of 20, because in my deepest crisis, although I went to some pretty good schools in England, my degrees in math and finance were pretty useless. What really saved me was a spiritual foundation. So when I got the news from homicide to tell me that Tariq had been shot and killed, my knee-jerk reaction was, no, that didn't make any sense. You know, he was a good kid. So I quickly hung up on homicide, thinking it was like a mistaken identity, because that happens a lot, you know, when crimes happen. I quickly called his apartment. He was dating Jennifer. They were both at San Diego State University. They had met there, been dating for 2.5 years. Got engaged and moved into the same apartment, you know, fully expecting him to pick up the phone. Well, he didn't. Jennifer did. And she couldn't say anything. She was just sobbing, because homicide went to their home first. So she knew before I did. I was just returning from a business trip in Mexico. So they came to my home, but I wasn't there. So they left a little note on my front door. So it hit when I called Jennifer. Back then, you didn't have cell phones, you know. And I remember I was in my kitchen. I lost strength in both of my legs as I collapsed to the floor, hit my head against the refrigerator and curled up in a ball. You know, the pain of an experience like that is hard to describe. I've never in my life felt pain like that. It was excruciating and it was unbearable. And I remember having my first out-of-body experience. And I believe in God. And I believe I left my body and went into the loving embrace of God. I don't recall how long I was gone for. Felt like a long time. God held me in this embrace. And when the explosion subsided, sent me back into my body with the wisdom that they are victims at both ends of the gun. I really didn't see the significance of that download. It kicked in pretty quickly because I had to make some very difficult, excruciating calls to his mother. I live here in San Diego. She lived in Seattle, Washington. And the hardest thing I've ever done, Jeff, you're a parent. How do you tell a mother she's never going to see her son again?
Yeah, that's really difficult.
You know, there's no book for that. And it took me a while. And when I finally told her, she let out this loud, piercing shriek, and she also hit the floor. I could actually hear her hit the floor on the phone. Thank God she wasn't by herself. And I finished a very broken conversation with one of her brothers. She was visiting her family in Vancouver. And when I tell this story, I can still hear her scream in my inner ear. It probably haunted me the rest of my life. I had to call my parents. I had to call my daughter. And it was a tough time for the Camisa family because my father had a 12-hour operation on Thursday, 7 bypasses, 4 they already had done before, and they had to redo them, and 3 again, 3 new ones. So you couldn't tell him. And I still today don't know how my mother visited my father in the hospital, knowing that she'd lost her grandson, but couldn't tell him.
Yeah, that'd be difficult.
I mean, I tell you, women are much more stronger than us men, because that I realized. Well, I couldn't go see my father because he would have seen that on my face, you know. So it was a very tough time. And then I called my best friend, you know. He lives in Ocean Beach. I've known him for 30-some years and helped him with some financing, and also very spiritual. And so he said, don't do anything. We'll be right over. So he and his wife came over to my house. And then Jennifer was by herself because her father is a dentist in the Navy and was posted in Hawaii. So his wife went to get Jennifer because I was so much in my own grief. I didn't even think about it. Then when they came, I thought, my God, you know, she's probably...
Right. How did I forget her?
Yeah. I mean, she was suffering. And I'm alone with my buddy. And, you know, and by this time, we had a visit from homicide. And they said we had some eyewitnesses. There were some young gang-involved people who were following up on those leads. And Dan, who is my best buddy, said to me, whoever these kids are that killed Tariq, I hope they fry in hell. That was his attitude. And this is an hour and a half after I found out. And my response to him, I don't feel that way. I see that there are victims at both ends of the gun. It didn't come from my intellect or my loving heart. It was a download from a higher power. Because right. I don't think us mortals can go there. Because I never really went on the road of revenge and retribution and anger and resentment. He was 14 years old. Somehow, I felt compassion for him too. Obviously, I had compassion for my son, but I saw him as a victim. That the real enemy wasn't the 14-year-old, but the societal peer pressure that forced many young men and women, as you know, that fall to the crack and then get involved with crime and gangs and drugs and alcohol and weapons. That was the real enemy. I didn't know much about youth gangs. I didn't even affect they existed. You know, my life was routinely flying from London, change planes, go to Tokyo, and I did a lot of international stuff. But now, obviously, I'm an expert at it. And 9 months later, we lose a young person like my son every waking hour. And that doesn't count the other kids that end up in prison. The kid who killed my son was sentenced as an adult. He was the first 14-year-old to be sentenced in California as an adult with a 25 years to life sentence. We lose them too. You know, I felt that as an American citizen, I'm a first generation naturalized American citizen. When I moved here 50 years ago. And love my country, I'm sure, you know, you do, and people that are listening to this podcast do. And I left because we were targeted. We were a minority in Kenya. And I don't know if you heard about Idi Amin in neighboring Uganda, who kicked out everybody who was not indigenous. My in-laws lived there. I was married at that time. My mother's family lived there. They were all kicked out. In 90 days, 90,000 people. So it was felt like it happened in Kenya. We weren't kicked out, but, you know, the writing was on the wall. We better get out of there. And that's, and since I was educated in the West, it was my turn to go and create a new life elsewhere. And I emigrated in 1974, thinking that my children would be safer here. So it's very ironic that he was actually killed on a country city that I picked for him. And my knee-jerk reaction was to leave. I grew up in England, which is a lot less violent than we are. But I realized that my love for this country was stronger than my anger. And I also learned that wherever I went, I had to still deal with. It's not something you can sweep under the rug.
Right.
So 9 months later, I decided to do something about it because I saw that Tariq was a victim of, Tony was the kid who took his life, and Tony was a victim of society. Of American society, because this is very much an American phenomenon. Other first world countries like ours don't have the kind of violence. And the question I ask is, you know, how did we create a society where children kill children in the richest nation in the world?
It doesn't make any sense, right?
No. How did we get here? I mean, we spend billions and sometimes trillions of dollars on wars on foreign soil. Yet every single day.
Meanwhile, there's a war actually happening right here.
Exactly. Right in our own backyards, our defenseless children are being wiped out in a frenzy of bizarre violence. It didn't make sense at all. So to honor Tariq, as well as to help my family deal with this awful tragedy in a positive way, I founded the Tariq Hamisa Foundation with the mission of stopping kids from killing kids. And essentially, we started with a mandate to save lives of children because we lose so many. It's important to do. Our second mandate was to teach nonviolence because I started with the premise violence is a learned behavior. Tony was not born violent. But if you accept that as an axiom, then nonviolence can also be a learned behavior, but you have to teach it. But where do our kids learn nonviolence? You know, I always say, if it bleeds, it leads. This is what you see on the news, you know? They don't cover stories like this, they mostly cover stories that are mostly violent. I mean, it shocked me that by the
time... Self-fear, right?
Yeah. Time our kids get to grade one, they're 6 years old, they've seen over 100,000 images of violence. Video games, movies, you know, action movies, whatever. So, you know, I thought we need to teach accountability. We need to teach kids to have socio-emotional skills like empathy, like compassion. Forgiveness was a big part of it. And to be proactively involved in peace building and peacemaking. We're not going to wake up one day and find out we're in peace, right? So that was the mission of the foundation, which is also in its 30th year now. And I've reached, personally, I've given over 1,000 student presentations, over 1 million. The foundation has reached a couple of million. Of course, our story has been shared in many books and media, and we've reached many more. But directly speaking, the foundation is very active in schools, and we essentially have what we call a safe school model. But soon after I started the foundation, I reached out to Tony's grandfather. So I started the foundation 9 months after Tariq died, and then had a launching meeting at my house. And then I asked the DA that handled my son's tragedy to introduce me to Tony's grandfather. We met in the public defender's office. I remember that. His name is Ples Felix.
And Tony was living with his grandfather, correct?
Yes. Tony actually was living with him since he was 8. Calls his grandfather daddy. His father was not in his life. And when we met in the public defender's office, I told him, you know, I'm not here thinking, you know, retribution and anger and resentment and revenge at your grandson or your family. Rather, I'm here in the spirit of compassion and forgiveness, because what I really see here, we both lost a son. I can't bring Tariq back. And there's nothing you can do to get Tony out of the criminal justice system. And I started this foundation with the mission of stopping kids from killing kids. It's a big job. I can't do this by myself. The real reason I'm here to ask for your help, because it behooves us to work together, because we both lost a son. Will you help me? So he was very quick to take my hand of forgiveness. And fast forward 30 years later, we're still together. He's Christian. He's a Baptist from the South. Master's degree in urban development. Worked for the city of San Diego as an enterprise manager. Had a lovely home in Lemon Grove for his grandson, and no clue that his grandson was gang involved. So the way we started the foundation is kind of interesting, because Tariq died in January. I started in October, and I had a team with my best friend and a lawyer at Hillier & Irvin, which is a law firm in town that gave us a free office, with a group of 5 people thinking, how are we going to do this? And then the phone rang in April of the year after, 1996. And it was the counselor from Burney Elementary School, which was Tony's alma mater, Carol Roblaskas. I still remember her name. And she says, these kids, because Tony's photograph was everywhere, because the first 14-year-old, there was a lot of media. So he was on TV, he was on newspaper. So the kids are confused. Is Tony a celebrity or is he a criminal?
Right.
It's the kind of the crazy world we live in.
Exactly.
And I can't answer these questions. So would you please come and talk to the kids? So Dan's wife, Kit, she was a founder of 3 legitimate theaters. So we saw this as a cry for help. So she organized this talk show assembly with me and the grandfather, and she moderated it. So there were 750 kids in Burney Elementary. So there are too many. So we broke them up into 3 different cohorts. So we would give the same presentation 3 times. And the kids would not stop asking questions. We had to finally say, you know, okay, we have to now stop. We have a second cohort starting. Pin drop silence. You know, we're talking to 4th, 5th, 6th graders, you know, and they were very attentive.
Yeah, you wouldn't expect that.
No, no fidgeting. So the next day I got a call from the principal, says, Mr. Camisa, the kids were so moved with the assembly you did here yesterday with Tony's grandfather, and they've written you letters. And I thought, oh, great, I'd love to see what the kids have to say. So I went to the school thinking I might get a dozen letters. She gave me 375 letters. 750 kids, every other kid wrote.
Wow.
I was blown away. So I thought, you know, maybe we have something.
We're on to something here.
Yeah, exactly. So
being a business guy, wait a minute. I see an opportunity.
Yeah, absolutely. It was definitely a validation that not only are these concepts of empathy and compassion and accountability and peace building teachable. Kids are hungry for it. And they came in with crayons and heart shapes. And I still have one on my wall that says, the ultimate expression of love is forgiveness. It's written by a sixth grader.
Wow. And
yeah, it's beautiful. So we started there. Today, we've given over 1,000 assemblies. And we have a safe school model because we figured that, you know, the assembly itself will shift attitude, but it was not going to change behavior. So we created what we call a curriculum where we teach empathy, compassion, forgiveness, peace building. Accountability is a big part of what we teach. And it's a 10-week curriculum, and we have three levels of it now. So the first is for fourth and fifth. The second level is sixth and seventh. The third is seven is eight and nine. And it goes to 10 as well. So we've stayed focused from 4th to 10th grade. And it's a very rich, it's probably the crown jewel of the foundation. It's named after my son, Tariq Amisa Foundation. We call it TKF. And it has tremendous demand. Our challenge is that a lot of the schools we go to don't have money.
Right.
In fact, we started in inner city schools and they said, we'd love to have you, but we don't have any money for it. And so, you know, I said, don't worry about it. I'll go raise the money. And we'll bring it to you for free. Because, you know, they didn't have money for basic needs. Like toilet paper. I think, my God, you know, we live in the richest nation in the world here. So we now have a reputation that TKF will bring the programs for free.
So much for that business mind.
So now it's not sustainable. You know, yeah, right. And that's my biggest challenge right now because I can only go to as many schools as I raise money for. Finally, schools are finally paying something for it after 30 years because... although they're still not paying 100%. I think maybe we get 30, 40% of it. We still have to raise 60%. And my hope is that someday we get this funded by the Department of Education because what we're teaching is probably as important as STEM. Most kids are not going to get PhDs, you know, but they're all going to be parents. So but it's very difficult to...
That question, what are we really teaching our kids, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
So we're doing well. We're still getting to... you know, we reach 20,000-30,000 kids every year, which is significant, but obviously we need to reach a lot more. So the safe school model now then, besides having the assembly and the 10-week curriculum, we were invited by UC Berkeley to create a program for parents. So based on restorative practices, this umbrella is restorative practices, which is actually more from restorative justice. So we now have a parenting program. And then during the pandemic, we created a program for teachers. And then going back to the kids, so the first program is an assembly. The second is a curriculum. We create a peace club on campus, which is basically a leadership program. We have 60, 70 titles of what it takes to be a nonviolent leader committed to peace building. Because
could use a little bit of that these days.
We need that a lot. And that's been a very successful program. The first two are during school hours. The peace club sometimes happens in the PE class or lunch or after school. And then we have a mentoring program for the kids that are on what I call the slippery slope. The one that are showing, they're very easy to pick. You can go into any classroom and the teacher will tell you they want to be gang members. So those typically end up getting suspended or expelled. So we say, don't expel them, don't suspend them. Give them to us. So we have mentors on campus. So if a kid misbehaves, they are sent to room 4C or whatever number is, where our mentors work with them, not only in school, but also in community and family.
So instead of sending them out to the gang.
Exactly.
It'd be all enrolled in that. It's like, let's give them an alternative.
Right. Because otherwise, you heard the adage, you know, school to prison pipeline. Because if you suspend a kid, he's not in school.
Right. Where is he going to go?
Exactly. So we've cut suspensions by 70%.
Wow.
Yeah. I wish it was 100%, which is kind of my goal because we should never suspend or expel kids. And there's no such thing as a bad kid. And, you know, violence is an expression of unresolved grief. And when you meet these people, Jeff, it tears me up. I've yet to meet an offender who was not a victim. And some of the abuse they go through as children.
Yeah, what led to this, right? How did you end up like this?
Yeah, and Tony was no different. And right. He had a very abusive childhood. He was very angry. You know, his father was not in his life. He was born to a 14 years old. So child raising a child.
So where's Tony today? This is a great story.
Yes, so that's a good story. So it took me 5 years to meet Tony. But I realized that at some point I had to come eyeball to eyeball with him to complete my journey of forgiveness. So finally, after, I don't know, a couple thousand hours of meditation, I told the grandfather, I said, I'm ready to meet Tony, because he stayed in touch with Tony. And so Pless reached out to him, and he wasn't ready, because Tony, the last person in the world he thought that would want to meet him would be me, right? But it didn't take him long. 6 months later, Pless told me he is ready. I said, I'd like you to go with me, because it's the first time I'm meeting Tony, but I need one-on-one with him because I have some tough questions for him. He was the last person to see my son. So Pless was very gracious. We spent the first half an hour mostly talking about his life in prison, which is not, it's pretty gruesome because prison life is...
Yeah, we're not grooming good citizens in our prisons, let's face it.
It's like a zoo, you know? So then he left us alone and I talked to Tony man to man for several hours. But the seminal moment in that, he was 19 years old. The seminal moment was during that time I spent with him, we locked eyeballs. I'm looking in his eyes, he's looking in my eyes. And he held that glance and I did too for what seemed like an uncomfortable time, thinking I'm going to find a murderer in him. But I didn't. I was able to climb through his eyes and touch his humanity, that I got that the spark in him was no different than me or you or anybody who's listening to this podcast. I could tell my hand of forgiveness had shifted him because he was well-mannered. He was articulate. He was remorseful. He didn't portray any of the typical attitudes of a 19-year-old gang member. Likeable kid. I wasn't expecting that. So I told him, I said, you know that I have forgiven you. I've been working with your grandfather for a good 4.5 years now. But I want you to know that when you come out of prison, you can come and work at the Tariq Kamisa Foundation, we have a job waiting for you. So after I finished talking with him, I said goodbye to him and the grandfather. And I remember walking out of the prison. He was at New Folsom Prison, which is by Sacramento. And I still remember that my stride walking away from the prison was a lot more bouncier than the one I walked in.
It's a good sign.
Yeah, because it was like a big albatross that had lifted. Forgiveness can be very freeing. And the preeminent thought in my head was, why did I wait 5 years? So it was very, very freeing. And then the next day I got a call from the grandfather saying, Azim, that meeting you had with Tony yesterday has turned him 180 degrees around. He said, as you were leaving, he said to me, Daddy, that is a special man. I killed his one and only son. Not only has he forgiven me, he's offered me a job. I'm not worthy of either. I'm going to try. And he says, he never said that before to me. He always said, he's a good-looking young person in an adult prison. He would say, Daddy, I'm not going to make it in prison. I'm going to die in prison. But he says, you gave him some hope. And he applied himself. He aced his GED at 22. Self-taught himself, because no real resources for kids or even adults in prisons. And I stayed with him from that time for 20 more years, advocating for his release. Mostly we wrote to each other every month because it was hard to go see him. And then sometimes you get to a prison, and there's a lockdown.
Yeah, you can't see him.
Yeah,
right?
So we communicated by mail. And finally in 2019, he went in front of the parole board. And I was there. My daughter was there. She's the executive director of her brother's foundation. The DA was there. Obviously, they don't want him to be released because the DA, although she's a good friend of ours, but, you know, it's an elected position and they don't want a murderer to come back into a community. But I told him, he's not the same person. 7 hours they grilled him. He cried a lot. Every altercation, because it's very easy. You can look at a guard in a wrong way and you're punished. So it's very easy to get into trouble. And Tony did. You know, he had some altercations. So they went through every one of them. Finally, I was allowed to speak. And, you know, my attitude to the commissioner was, you know, Tony has work to do, not behind bars. You know, release him. We will hire him in the foundation. I'll vouch for his behavior. Because you can tell he's not the same person he was when he killed my son at 14. But think about how many kids he can save when he's on stage with me. And he tells his story, because he joined a gang at 11, killed my son at 14, and he wishes he could turn the clock back. I said, how many kids?
Yeah, your story is great, but getting it from him, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a whole different story.
Yeah, and he relates to them.
Yes.
So release him, because I know we've saved him. He can save many, many more. Because the kids, you know, we reach thousands of kids every year. And it's quite high percentage in inner cities that end up in gangs. And then my daughter also spoke, and she met him a lot later. She probably met him 4 or 5 years before he was released. He was 39 years old. So he's 44 now. And even the commissioner was in tears. He says, "Mr. Commissioner, I've been doing this for 25 years. Never had the victim's father and the victim's sister advocate for the offender's release." So Tony won parole. So he came out in 2019. And for the last almost 6 years now, he's volunteering for the foundation. He's a plumber. We found him a job at Anderson Plumbing. They support us.
She's been on the podcast.
Oh, yes. Okay.
Yeah, Mary Jean. Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, Mary Jean knows us well. And they hired him because she supports the foundation.
Wow. I didn't know that.
Nice lady. And he is off Fridays and Saturdays. So on Fridays, he's often with me on talking to kids. And he's very involved with the foundation. He's on the board. And he loves talking to kids. And he's able to talk to them in a way that I can't, because he knew the street and all of that. So it's a full story. And when you think about it, it just shows you what's possible. And I could have taken the position, hanging from the highest pole. It took my one and only son. A lot of my friends felt that way.
Sure. That's the normal thing.
Yeah. Because when you lose a kid, you typically go through a divorce. I was already divorced, so that was not an issue. And typically you leave town. You lose your friends. I've never left all my friends. I'm even tighter friends as a result of this. But the big thing is, it just shows you now what's possible, that the power. And I'm glad that I had the eyes. You know, I thank the good Lord that, you know, I was able to take something that was so negative and get to a higher place. And forgiveness was the way. And it was the right choice for me, because I could have gone the other way. I could have done a lot of damage. I'm a passionate kind of guy, as you know. So,
anyway. Yeah, that's crazy. Azeem, you're amazing. So let me take you to today. Yesterday in the Tribune, on the front page was an article, "Expletive and Worst Plague, SD County Public Meetings." And the whole article was about how people are showing up and threatening and just cursing and doing all these things, and how difficult it is to be a public official now. It's like, it's not even safe.
Right.
Where are we going? What's your thoughts? I mean, being a man of peace and forgiveness, the world seems to be spinning the wrong direction here.
Definitely is. And, you know, I've been also pondering on this a lot. Sometimes a pendulum has to swing all the opposite way before it comes back.
Uh-oh.
But I believe there is a divine order to the universe. And I think you see that in our constellations, because the only reason we've appreciated constellations is because every planet and star is in the right place for millions of years, and they're moving around in dizzying space. So there is some kind of a divine order, what they call karma or the rule of law. But systematic violence is what we are seeing now, is difficult to reverse. But I believe it will shift because of the divine order, but it may not shift in mine and yours timeline.
Oh, yeah,
it will shift in the universe's timeline. So what do? So you become a catalyst to maybe shorten the timeline. So I'm increasing my work in voice. I think there's more of us that want the other way than what we are seeing, because that's what our founders wanted. But we also have this faction in our society which is going the other way. And I think that we have to make sure that we don't resort to violence. If you look at some of the historic examples, like Gandhi, like Mandela, like MLK, like Desmond Tutu with the Truth and Reconciliation Committee in South Africa. I actually met Desmond Tutu. I got an award with him. He's passed on. That we need to become more active in being nonviolent. As Gandhi used to say, there's no stronger weapon in our arsenal than nonviolence, because you can't destroy it. But hopefully there is more of us. I mean, I'm seeing more protests. I'm on my way to D.C. tomorrow. And I'm seeing that more people are getting engaged to try and create a catalyst that we can reverse this order. It will reverse, no doubt in my mind, because it's not...
It's just a matter of when.
Yeah, right? You know, we've gone through a lot in America, right? You create an amazing country in 250 years, and we've been through civil war, and we went through... breaking away from the United Kingdom. And we've been through two world wars and we've been through a lot. And I truly believe that there is a resiliency in the American people, which is probably something you don't see in the world. And I do believe that maybe we will have to wait till this thing turns around. It's not going to happen tomorrow. I wish it could, but there's no magic wand. But hopefully people that are listening to this needs to get engaged and understand that this will shift, but we need to shorten the timeline. And how do you do that is by being engaged.
Show up.
Yeah. Show up. And I'm doing that. I'm speaking more and doing more podcasts like this one to promote the idea that this is not what our founders had in mind.
What role does business have in this?
A big one, I think. I think business is a big role. And I'll tell you why. Because I've created two nonprofits, and I also created a program for youth offenders in a different nonprofit, which is now in 12 states. But the resources in nonprofits are very difficult. And that's the challenge. Well, business has resources that nonprofits do not have, but they also have leadership. So one of the things, one of my books is Leadership for the Greater Good. What I'm advocating is that as a business, you are a leader. Whether you are CEO, CFO, or a C-suite, or even if you are in managerial position, you are a leader. But since you are a leader, you have to understand you just don't live at home and work. You also live in community. And what would we do without community? No police, no hospitals, right? No streets, no freeways. We take community for granted.
Yes, we do. Yep.
So I believe the kind of leaders we need today, they have to have a triad of competency. Sure, they need to be very good at whatever their endeavor is, whether they're lawyers or doctors or professionals. But number two, since they live in community, because most of leadership is about me, 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 you know, which was the yuppie crowd, which is kind of where I grew up, but millennials and Gen Zs, and they seem to be more socially conscious. But I think we need leaders to understand that because you are a leader, you need to take on some community challenge. Every community has some issues.
Address all stakeholders.
Yeah.
Everybody.
Like I took on the problems of youth violence and have made a big difference. Although I wasn't trained in social services, but I understood as a successful banker that I had leadership qualities. So they need to get engaged. And exactly what we're talking about earlier, right now, you know, the country is going the wrong way, that we need to really take on community engagement. And number three, we need to have leaders espouse strong ethical, moral, and spiritual values. Now, how many leaders can you think of that are good at what they do, with whatever their endeavor is, have gotten involved with community engagement, and have strong ethical, moral, and spiritual values? You do, Jeff. You have all of those three qualities, and you're teaching it, but there are very few Jeffs around that have this triad of competencies. So I think businesses have very good opportunity to understand. I just spoke, I belong to an executive peer group. I spoke at one of the other guys in my group, manages apartments, and they also buy their own and they manage apartments for others. And it was very interesting. And he's a millennial. And he's very conscious about wanting his people to get involved with community. And I spoke at his annual meeting in San Diego, and two of his employees had gone through the program of Tariq Kamisa Foundation. Well, we know we are. So I think we need to spawn this idea that it's not just you and your families that you look after. Because you know, we tend to be very materialistic, and we tend to be very individualistic. We need to be more pluralistic. And I think it has given me a lot of meaning because I think at the end of the day, you're here to serve. I think Pope Francis passed away today, and I think he's a very good example.
Yes.
That you're here to serve others, not just yourself. And I think we need more of it. It's a great quote from Rabindranath Tagore. He's an Indian sage. He said, "I dreamt life was joy. I woke up and I found out life was service. I acted and behold, service is joy." I think we need leaders.
I actually quoted that in, I think, my last podcast.
You did?
Yes.
Okay, so the people will remember that. Yeah.
We're drilled into it, I guess.
Yeah. And I think when people do go out and get engaged in community and go out and serve, I mean, I got into it because of my tragedy, but it has been very fulfilling. You know, my first book was From Murder to Forgiveness and then Forgiveness to Fulfillment. having, you know, personally having given 1,000 presentations to over 1 million kids and having 150 some thousand letters now, I know that I made a difference in many kids and changed their trajectory. And then I followed that up from fulfillment to peace. And Tony actually wrote the foreword to it. So it's a 25-year-plus journey. It started very dark with murder. But today, you introduced me as feeling very calm and peaceful. And I am it.
That is you, my friend.
I think the portal was forgiveness. You know, I spoke at Bishop's in 2019, November. Bishop's very expensive school, as I'm sure you know. It's $35,000 a year. It's in La Jolla. It's 800 kids, 200 faculty, 1-to-4 ratio. Most of those kids end up in Ivy League schools. And I spoke to 1,800, all the faculty was there. And after I spoke, normally it's a long line of people want to come and spoke to me, and happened the same here. And then there was one girl that was a senior. Bishop's goes, I think, from 4th grade to 12th grade, came up to him and said, Mr. Camisa, it's nice to see you again. You changed my life. And I said, well, tell me more. He said, well, I was in 7th grade. You came to speak at my school. And I'm thinking, yeah, that would have been an inner city school. What is she doing at Bishop's? She says, I was about 13 years old. I was put into the foster care system at the age of 8. Your story inspired me to forgive my biological mother for all the pain she had caused me in my life, forgive all my foster parents for all the confusions they had caused in my life, and I applied myself, won a scholarship to Bishop. I just graduated with a 4.7 and have a free ride at UCLA. She actually co-emceed our 25th anniversary. But I could see the determination right in this young lady. It wouldn't surprise me that when she finally graduates, she will take on the foster care system in our country because it's broken, as you know. I get this a lot.
Right. That's the story, right? Go out and do a little service and see what happens. You might be amazed.
Yeah. And I think, yeah, it's been very fulfilling. And I think the ability to become pluralistic from being an individualistic is the shift I think we need to create in this country.
Yes.
Because while we've done amazing, we built an amazing country in 250 short years. When it comes to violence, we are a very bad role model.
Yeah, we're leading the parade in that one too. not one we should be proud of. But
yeah, exactly.
Yeah, unfortunately.
I think we need to shift that because being the richest nation, we have a big impact on the social cultures of the globe.
Yes.
While we're exporting some good stuff, free market, democracy, although that's another conversation, we're also exporting our violence.
Well, we got to put a bow on this, Azeem. I always like to end with, you've shared so many amazing things, but what's the one big idea? People remembered one thing, what would that be?
Good question. I will say that the book that inspired me to fulfillment to peace was based after 9/11. And I meditate now 2 hours a day. And 9/11 is very heavy on everybody's hearts. We lost 3,000 innocent people, but they came from all over the world. And it's a little heavier on my heart because I'm a practicing Muslim and the perpetrators were from my faith. And I went into this very deep introspective space for many months thinking the same faith helped me to get to forgiveness. It's not the faith. It's power, petrodollars, geopolitics, lots of theories out there. And finally, what I downloaded was this quote. So I think this would be a good place, good way to put a bow on our conversation. It goes like this, that sustained goodwill creates friendship. You start there with goodwill because you don't make friends by bombing them, right? Over many years of goodwill, you create friendships, right? If you count your friends, probably on one hand, but it's goodwill for many, many years. Sustained goodwill creates friendship based on my relationship with the grandfather and Tony as well. Sustained goodwill creates friendship. Sustained friendship creates trust. Sustained trust creates empathy. Sustained empathy creates compassion, which makes forgiveness possible. It worked for me. It worked for my family. It can work for you, and it can work for whoever is listening to these episodes and their family. It can work for the United States because it is the portal to peace, because that forgiveness will eventually bring us to peace. It has for me.
All right. That's a drop the mic. Azeem, you're the best, man. I appreciate you. And the work you're doing is just so phenomenal over all these years and the impact you're having. And like you said, like the girl that can come up to you and say, man, you changed my life. You're like, whoa, how did this even come to be? Mm-hmm. There's just like thousands of those stories out there.
Oh, yeah. I spoke at San Diego State University, and that was a kid who came up to me and said, Mr. Camisa, you changed my life. Very similar. And I said, well, tell me more. I said, when I was in seventh grade, you came to my school. And I know you were a banker, so I decided to make you my role model and not follow my older brother, my father, and my grandfather, who were all gang involved. These kids will not be. So this stuff is teachable and gives me hope, and it gives me the energy to go out and do more, you know? But we need more. We need more Jeffs in the world, too.
Let's keep up the good fight. What do you say? And hopefully this goes out to all our business leaders that realize they have a role to play in this, right?
Business
is the biggest influencer in the world. So
I agree.
We need to start influencing in a positive way.
Yeah, I agree with you. And we have some good role models there. Yes. You know, I think Warren Buffett is a good role model. In fact, I'm going there after I get back from D.C. I think Bill Gates is a good model. We have some other ones that are not such good models.
Yeah, we got a mixed bag for sure. Well, I want to thank you for coming in today. Should have done this a long time ago, but the timing's probably perfect given what's going on in the world today. So
Thank you. You're very welcome. Thanks for having me.
Well, that's our show for today. And if you enjoyed it, please subscribe, comment, and most importantly, share the podcast with a friend. Again, special thanks to our collaborative community of San Diego business organizations, the Better Business Bureau, Conscious Capitalism, Be Local, and Cause San Diego. We're all using the influence of business to positively impact our very own community of San Diego. I'm Jeff Blanton from Jailbreak Leadership saying, until next time, go do what you do. Go do what you do best, for we're all counting on you.